Hi, I'm Ben.
And I'm Stefan.
Hi, Stefan. I'm running out of things to say.
You're Michael.
And we're animating in threes. This is an animation podcast where three guys talk about an animated series or movie from an animator's perspective. And this week, we're going to be talking about
2001's Atlantis.
Okay. If you want to skip over to any section of this podcast, make sure to look at the descriptions below, and you'll be able to skip this next section if you want, which is animation news.
So, Ben, what has been happening in the animating world?
Let's go to my favorite thing, which is the fact that the Clone Wars Season 7 got a trailer, finally.
I saw that.
And it looks good. I really like it. And the animation and the rendering is just so much better. Even though it was already good from
what
really
we said. I'm really confused what team works on the Clone Wars animation, because it's the same, obviously it's the same production that does Rebels, but why does Clone Wars exclusively get the good animation and the good rendering?
Well, because way back when it was actually airing, like, weekly, George Lucas just put a lot of his own money into it, so they could outsource a lot more animation and get it done better.
So has he done the same for this season 6?
So what I'm guessing for this season, which is season 7.
Oh, season 6.
Instead of doing 24 episodes, they're doing 12. So I'm guessing they used that extra money that they would have done for the extra 12 and put it into these 12.
Mm.
So it's like each episode has double the budget.
Every Star Wars trailer from the past like 5 years has just been the John Williams main theme played really dramatically over pictures of people looking sad.
Yep.
That's been every trailer.
Isn't that like every trailer ever, not just Star Wars?
Yeah. This is
Every trailer has John Williams Star Wars.
Every trailer is set to John Williams Star Wars music and it's just people looking sad.
Yep. I agree, 100%.
12 years a slave. Da 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 da.
Okay. So last year we talked a bit about how Marvel Television closed down.
Yes. Yep. They rebranded or something.
Yes, they have rebranded and they're to separate themselves from Marvel Studios Disney Plus series. So it's going to be called Marvel TV Studios. How amazing is that?
So they're still going to make network television series.
Yes, but it's under a different banner now.
Okay.
But does that still mean those will only be exclusive to Disney Plus?
I don't think so, no. Especially considering this other piece of
animation. So
they're
still
going
to have network, because I presume that would just bring everything under Disney Plus.
Yeah.
And that was it.
No, so we'll check out this that's coming to Hulu.
Ooh, what's coming to Hulu, Ben?
So they're making Marvel's MODOK.
Oh, the Patton Oswalt project. This was part of the Avengers lineup, yeah.
So there's Patton Oswalt. There's Ben Schwartz, voicing Sonic.
Yep.
There is Melissa Fumero, who's from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. She plays Amy.
Oh, she's fun, yeah.
Who's MODOK?
MODOK
is a giant head in a floating chair with
arms
and legs.
I remember him from Marvel Ultimate Alliance,
too. Yeah, he's a mechanical organism designed only for killing.
I thought he was a bad guy.
I think that's what it stands for.
Is he a bad guy?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
He looks ridiculous. He's the funniest looking Marvel villain.
Okay, well, let's go on to the next series. Apparently, they're making a Prince Harry show starring Orlando Bloom.
Oh, what? No. What?
Why?
Is he playing Prince Harry?
Yes.
What?
That's really fun. That's... What?
Wait. But wait, is this animated?
Yes.
What?
It's animated. What do you think this podcast
is? Oh, it's animated.
Why would they make an animated...
Sorry, I just pictured Orlando Bloom trying to pass as Prince Harry. He just walks up to the Queen and is like, ah, madre.
What the heck is this? It looks like
drawings
of Mark Knight from the Herald Sun newspaper.
I just read the...
Is this a parody? Because they all look gross.
It should be. I'm guessing they just decided to air it. They do it because of the whole
I was
going to
say, this clearly
recently.
Isn't in collaboration with the royal family.
No, not at all. But that is bizarre. Like,
Harry in that picture looks like he's breathing through his mouth.
I'm amazed that they would even allow that.
Well, if it's an American thing, they have no say over that.
Yeah.
Okay, last piece of animation news. They're making Pokemon the movie, but in 3D.
Again.
And on Netflix.
It's been for a while.
I know, right? It has been for a while, but they released a trailer for it. They released a Netflix date, which is next month.
Pokemon, the 23rd first movie.
No, it's Mewtwo Strikes Back Evolution.
Again.
I think the style of it is alright, though. It's just, you don't need to do that movie again, though. You know?
Yeah, but it's an anniversary thing, so it kind of makes sense.
Or release in HD!
So are they remastering it or remaking it?
Remaking it in 3D.
But a lot of shows in Japan nowadays are doing that, where to celebrate big years, they're now just remaking an original series as 3D, because now they have a much better comprehension of CG implications.
Ben has showed me something on his phone, and the audience has no frame of reference for what he's looking at, but that looks quite good.
Yeah.
It looked good, but there's just no need for it.
No, but still.
Did that Detective Pikachu movie make money?
Yes.
I don't know, I didn't see it.
Because, like, I felt like it would be the biggest thing in the world, because it's, like, the first kind of big-budget Hollywood live-action Pokemon movie, and just no one talks about it anymore.
Yeah. I thought it was a decent film. It grossed almost $431 million, which is pretty decent. Like, it made its money back more than, like, twice over. So.
But isn't that, like, doesn't that roughly equate to your marketing budget, so it kind of broke even? Because is it like if a film costs like $200 million, then by extension, the studio usually spends about $200 million on marketing?
It cost around $150 million, so it made roughly three times that.
That's okay.
Yeah, I would say that's
a moderate success, yeah.
Yeah.
But now if everything doesn't make literally all the money in the world, then it's an incredible financial failure.
Talking about incredible financial failures, Atlantis!
That's actually a good segue.
So, Atlantis Lost Empire is a 2001 traditionally animated, with CGI elements, science fiction adventure film. It's the 41st, for some reason I wrote 41st Disney animated feature, and unlike the many musicals produced by Disney of the time, this sought to be an explosive action adventure.
Yeah, and more adventure films.
Yes, we do. Like more Tintin. Of them.
Exactly, like Tintin. But not that ugly.
Maybe with that sort of cinematography, but not that rendering.
I like it, but still, go on.
So, the film was directed by Gary Truesdale, Kirk Wise, and produced by Don Hahn. Oh my goodness.
I don't know who they are.
It is so much easier to pronounce names that aren't foreign.
Yeah.
I can actually say
To be fair, Stefan, they are foreign to Australia.
Well, yeah, still, but...
Welcome to our new segment, Stefan's a Massive Racist.
Hooray! With screenplay by Tab Murphy. Prior to the film's development, these guys had discussed keeping the Hunchback of Notre Dame team together to create an adventure film inspired by old 60s adventure features, Indiana Jones, and Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Mm. Ah, yeah, not the Brendan Fraser one that hadn't come out yet?
I actually liked the first one, the one with Brendan Fraser. Brendan Fraser's awesome.
But this isn't the one, this isn't the Time Machine with that other dude. What's that? That Time Machine movie. Who's in that Time Machine movie? It's literally just called The Time Machine.
I've never... Siri,
who's in The Time Machine?
Apple.com should be able to help you with that.
Oh, they're talking about Time Machine for Apple products where you can back up stuff.
Oh, no, I want my real Time Machine.
Stefan, go on.
So the film's visuals were heavily influenced by Mike Mignola's graphic art style, so he's the creator of Hellboy.
Oh, yeah, I thought that sounded familiar.
And by ancient Mayan, Indian, Cambodian, and Tibetan architecture. Yeah. So you got everything there. Despite what is seemingly a well-constructed and planned project, like, if you see the behind the scenes, it's an absolutely incredible documentary. This is how you make an animated film. It was all planned, everything had... They had outsourcing, they had everything managed. So despite them doing all the right things... The film received an average box office performance of $186 million.
How much did it cost to make?
From a production of $120
million. Oh, so that's not good at all.
They didn't make anything. And mixed reception...
Was that just domestic or worldwide?
Worldwide.
When did this come out?
2001. Same time as Shrek, which I'll talk
about. Oh, okay, yeah.
And mixed reception due to its confusing target audience and the public's keener interest towards 3D animated features.
Yeah. It came out at the wrong time.
Exactly. Mm. And what it really... kills me about this film is if this was released nowadays, it would be great. It's got great characters, it's got great visuals, it's got a great adventure.
It doesn't feel like a Disney film. It feels like a Netflix original.
Yeah, because it's so still, not Disney.
I still feel like it's Disney.
It's got that critical kind of bite to it. Mm. I love how just everyone's just chain smoking and wearing singlets and just packing guns.
Yeah,
like that was my favorite part of it. Just like this feels like a real kind of angry adult world.
Also, did you
that's accessible to children?
Did you try to count the kill count in this movie?
So many people die.
Everyone dies.
Everyone dies horribly, and it's mostly in explosions.
Oh, so it's Rogue One.
But good with characters I remember.
But one review that really killed me when I read it
was
where I told you about it, was where it said This film tries to do stuff different but doesn't succeed as opposed to the much superior Shrek. Now, Shrek is a great film.
Apples and oranges.
Seeing that written down in an actual review nowadays, considering Shrek is now a meme, just sounds so weird.
Also, they're incomparable.
They're like, two different things.
Yeah. Apples and onions.
Yeah. One's an adventure film, one's a buddy film. One's 3D, one's 2D. They have different scopes of story.
This is I don't think animation was as appreciated as an art craft form. Because nowadays, this film should really be looked at just how stunning the visuals and designs are. Like, it looks incredible.
Also, 3D animation there was still kind of exciting and niche. Yeah. Now there's one released every 15 minutes.
Whereas now, if this 2D
look,
film...
Look, 9 more Toy Stories came out while we were talking.
Yeah. But yeah.
Well, actually, they're still doing the Toy Story... the person who sits on the lamp.
She's getting a short film.
She's got a short film now.
Why? Oh, yeah, animation news. She's getting a short film later this month.
Why?
Because... about her on the lamp. Remember how she was on the lamp?
It's about her story between Toy Story... Do you know how in that flashback of Toy Story 4...
I want to spin off about whatever happened to that penguin.
No.
What happened to that penguin? We just never saw him again.
He died.
Did he?
Yeah, he lost his voice completely.
And then the dog ate him.
Oh.
Dog ate him.
That's my headcanon.
And you contracted pneumonia.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, no.
So, the film centers around Milo Thatch, a cartographer and linguist who dreams of following in his grandfather's footprints. Funded by his grandfather's best friend, Milo embarks on an expedition with a group of explorers to find the lost city of Atlantis. The quest to discovering the lost city soon turns into a mission to save the civilization and its citizens, as Milo, his team, and Princess Keita go forth to restore the heart of Atlantis. So... a bit about the trivia. If you have a chance to see the 2-hour documentary these guys made of the film, I highly recommend it. It was back at the time when Disney did good documentaries that went nitty-gritty into how they designed things.
And not just everyone got along well on set. Harrison Ford definitely liked being here, and we didn't have to draw him out of his trailer with whiskey.
Can I say something about the Star Wars behind the scenes, putting stuff together? Yeah. So they were going to release an art book around this time.
Oh, can you tell me about this? Because I heard about this, yeah.
But for some reason, they've recalled it so they can change things.
Mm.
And I bet it's because of all the leaked stuff about Colin Trevorrow's episode 9.
Do you think it... like?
I reckon they want to damage control that.
You think there might be some merit to those leaks?
Yeah, Colin Trevorrow has confirmed a lot of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was just because... I thought, presumably, they made no comment because that's what...
I just think that what they're doing with the art book is they're taking some of that stuff out so people don't remember it.
Oh, damn. Like, yeah, don't forget about what could have been. Yeah. Enjoy the film now.
Exactly.
Palpatine had sex. That's what we want you to know. Think about that.
Anyway, sorry about that tangent.
It has nothing to do with animation, but I really want to keep that line.
Palpatine has sex.
That's what Disney wants you to remember.
So at the start...
Thinking about it!
When I was saying the introduction, I said how the directors and them basically... they basically sat at a Mexican restaurant and discussed what their next film ideas would be. And they basically said that they wanted to make a film about a team of experts wanting to go and conquer something. Like, if you notice, this Atlantis... you don't have the typical Disney thing of, oh, he's a lone boy who has no talent and now he's amazing.
He doesn't have any parents...
He's a cartographer and linguist, and everyone in the film is an expert in their field because it actually inspired them from when they were working as being animators, where they'd go on adventures, just them being a bunch of really talented people trying to figure out how to make a film.
No, yeah, this movie was very much just like, who needs parents when you have a gun?
So this became the ethos for the creation of the character dynamics within the film. Basically, a bunch of experts, and as they quote here, a bunch of guys and gals in tank tops on a sweaty action adventure.
Yeah, that's what I liked about it. Everyone was just sweating so much.
And everyone had a tank top.
Everyone was wearing tank tops. Even the military dude, who was dressed immaculately when he was introduced, was just wearing a tank top and underpants by the end.
Very gritty and grimy. And yeah, it was great.
Everyone was so angry and just wanted to shoot everyone all of the time.
And everyone's hair actually looked like they hadn't showered in a while.
Yeah.
So they wanted it to be a callback to olden style of cinema, but in animated form. So like your 60s action adventures, those serials. And they wanted to create a first film for Adventureland Disney. Because at this time, all the films had been for like the fairy tale side of the Disneyland. Mm. They wanted to do one for Adventureland, which is like your... Pirates of the Caribbean, that sort of thing.
Yeah, those are the fun ones.
But they could have done Tarzan. Done that for Tarzan, though.
Probably. Tarzan was still a musical. These guys sought out to make this not a musical.
Oh, this was really lacking that, really missing that Phil Collins soundtrack. We're in a sub! Oh no, a crab! I don't know.
I guess we're now all dead.
Bang, 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 bang.
Damn it.
Okay.
And that's just the gunshots.
Yeah, yeah.
So, a few notes I got from the documentary of this film. Ed Gerda was the layout supervisor, and he had to sell the team on basically making this widescreen, because all their other films
had been
in box.
It looks amazing, yeah.
But he said that widescreen, because this is an adventure, would be able to get more scenery, more atmosphere, and you'd be able to do a lot more.
But wouldn't
they
already make it in widescreen?
No.
But what about all the old Disney films? Aren't they made in widescreen?
No.
What's the traditional aspect... What's the cinematic aspect ratio for traditional Disney films?
I don't have that here because I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Oh, because I swear
they're not
going to
be like 4x3.
Because when they release like the DVD, they have all the extra edges in widescreen.
This is
widescreen.
One of the first ones they said that did widescreen, so I'm going to take that for what it
I'm
is.
Assuming that means cinematic widescreen, like that 22x9x1 or whatever.
Yeah, not like 16x9.
It's like cinematic widescreen, not like 16x9.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair so enough. It basically required bigger drawings if they were going to do it just the widescreen they wanted. However, they worked out that making the drawings for the widescreen smaller, so if they made everything 30% smaller, they could actually be more efficient and give the animators more room to move the characters within the world. So if you imagine, the backgrounds in every of the drawings, instead of being massive, are actually quite small. But because it's still in the widescreen, you can't really tell. Yeah. But it also gives them more leeway for the characters to move because technically there's more room.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we were right. The aspect ratio for Atlantis: The Lost Empire is 2.35x1, so it's a cinematic aspect ratio.
Yeah,
yeah. So that must have been brand new. So that's extra wide.
So that's why in this film there's a lot of cinematic shots where it's just looking at the backgrounds because they have that extra room to be able to emphasize on it. And man, are the mats gorgeous in this.
Yeah, there's a part of the mats. I not really mats, but this I'll get into it.
Yeah. So. Emphasizing emotional storytelling through background paintings, blues for peace and romance, reds for anger, that sort of thing. Lisa Keen, the background supervisor, worked out diagrams to explore basically a working model of the entire Atlantis ecosystem, just so she could imagine how light would fall in certain scenes. Mm. So this lady basically worked out how they'd get water, how they'd get supplements and everything to this culture, just so she could work out how it would look and how it would feel.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then she basically imagined, okay, imagine the crystal is the central battery for everything, and then that would undermine the ecosystem and whatnot.
Okay.
And hearing that, it's really impressive how it's not just the screenwriter who works on making this world. It's everyone involved has a little piece. And I feel like there's a lot of animations nowadays that don't have that communication between the different fields. And even in this documentary, they said this old Disney trait called plussing, they called it, where anything anyone brings to the table can only make it better. Mm. And so they listen to every idea, they listen to everything and just make it, and eventually it becomes something grand.
What if they said, let's bring a clown in it, and he says, hi.
What if we... what if the clown's racist?
No.
What if we just have the whole civilization be racist clowns?
Yeah, would that have been a better idea? Is
all
that plussing?
There are no bad ideas. Make the film about racist clowns.
All voiced by Mark Hamill.
Oh, that is better.
You know, I really like the voice acting in this. So.
Yeah, Michael J. Fox is a excellent choice.
Fex animation was supervised by Marlon West, who focused on the bubbles, lava, and pretty much everything that was moving that wasn't characters. Like,
he
said that this was the biggest VFX film he's ever done.
And there was quite a bit as well. So.
Oh, it's a spectacle.
Yeah,
like
if this was ever lasers is everything.
If this was ever theatrically re-released, I'd 100% go see it.
The final multiplane shot at the time is regarded as the most difficult shot in the entire film.
Oh, which multiplane?
Where it zooms out from Keita and Milo and sees the whole city of Atlantis with everything moving.
Yes,
because
what
it basically is...
Is that the last shot of the film?
Yeah, last shot. Is it started with one little drawing and basically they just added all different drawings to everything. It's not just one image. They went from like a 7x11 paper to like a massive pieces of paper and composite. It was insane.
Wow. Yeah, I could kind of tell that when I was watching it.
So they sought to make it more like a moving comic book with sharp angles and dynamic compositions. So David Gotaz, who was the art director, utilized more freelancers than usual for a usual Disney production. So instead of just sticking to their in-house, they got a lot of outside people, which is what gives it that different look from a Disney.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of moments when like the characters don't go off model, but there's a lot more fluidity with
in-betweens.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot.
I'm talking more in the art direction.
Oh, the art direction. Design. I was gonna say because there's a lot of like caricaturing and warping in the in-betweens more so than I felt was normal for a Disney film.
Mm-hmm.
So to bring an entirely different look and feel to Atlantis and make it feel more raw and kind of comic booky, they got Matt Codd, who designed the Leviathan and Submarine, and he does a lot of like gothic kind of architecture stuff. Jim Martin, who did the sub pods. Ricardo Delgado, who did the sets of Atlantis and all the caves that they go through that transitions from the industrial world to the organic Atlantis world. And Mike Mignola, who did Hellboy and all that and had that really distinct art style.
Yeah, he likes his big chins.
There's this interview with him where he was brought in on the project and he saw that they had like pin-up boards of how to draw like Mike Mignola, and they had all these things of how to animate hands and whatnot. And he said something like, what are these terms you're saying? I have no idea how you've broken down my art because I just draw it and that's my style.
Yeah.
And he
yeah.
was impressed by just how they interpreted his style and like very articulate wording and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think everyone's like that. Everyone just kind of draws innately.
Yeah.
You don't really overthink your style, or you're not consciously aware of how you're composing any one piece of art.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. It would be interesting to have your work kind of critiqued like that.
I
want to say critiqued, I'd say just broken down.
Oh, broken down, analyzed, probably
yeah,
a better word.
Analyzed, yeah. There we go.
In terms of character animation, they said the hardest thing to do was get his fingers, his style of fingers, because they were really blocky with big nails.
Blocky and flat tips.
And apparently that was really difficult for all the Disney animators, so they needed to like keep
Who are we talking about recently that always did that?
Who
was that designer for Hades in...
Oh, yeah.
The Hercules one.
Yeah, we're talking about that guy. Likes his flat tips.
It's pretty obvious, but the two visuals of the film that they wanted to emphasize was the clunky World War One era steam-driven industrial characters who invade Atlantis and the more mysticism and organic reliance they have.
Mysticism.
No, I loved like the steampunky.
I loved both styles and how like they also kind
they
of joined together when
yeah.
they
yeah, and
invaded
it's not
as
quite,
well.
And it's not quite steampunk.
Like, no, it's not. It's yeah, just very industrial.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everything's
but like futuristic industrial.
Yeah, yeah, because steampunk like the whole steampunk not dystopia, but the whole steampunk aesthetic is based around kind of using steam as a primary source of fuel.
Yeah.
But they live in an era when they've started to develop internal combustion engines.
Mm.
So they do live in an era with a developing fuel source, but it's taken elements from that kind of steampunk over-industrialized, almost militaristic aesthetic. I think the whole thing is beautiful. Especially, I wish we spent more time in that massive sub, because that's...
The sub is amazing. Yeah. And talking about the sub, that was 3D, as you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they actually had a big reliance on 3D assets, despite it being a 2D animation film.
Mm.
Like, the Leviathan that attacks them is all 3D.
Yeah, you can tell. It's composited nicely, but
it works well. I think it works incredibly.
And also, it makes sense. We always talk about Futurama, how Futurama always uses 3D model composites to depict either vehicles or futuristic technology, and that kind of does the same thing.
Mm.
All the organic stuff is completely hand drawn, and a lot of the ancient technology and giant like robotic monstrosity guardians are all digital
3D.
So, good movie.
Do you want to keep going?
Opening thoughts actually?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's kind of like it's kind of a free flow conversation thing. Anyone can do a podcast basically.
Right.
It's so easy. I loved it.
Yeah, same.
Probably enjoyed rewatching it more than Shrek. Shrek is next week, by the way, everyone.
Yeah, adventure films are one of my favorite genres just because
they're really so fun.
Yeah, they're just fun
they're pulpy,
but like you get to see these characters just overcome all these obstacles and challenges.
Mm.
And then when they get to the treasure, they have this moment of crisis. Like, should I take it? Should I not?
It's
then,
always no. Every single film.
Exactly.
I want one when they get to the end and then just go, God damn, I want to take that treasure. And they just take it and everything's fine.
Oh, you know what? Uncharted. The first one, they take treasure.
Oh, they do actually. They do take it. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. That's
apart from that one thing,
that's kind of a fun playing with the trope where they're just like, "Here's all this treasure." Oh, we did take it because it's treasure.
Mm. But no, adventure films—they're great. They have had a bit of a decline in film recently, which I think kind of sucks. But that means whenever one pops up and it's a real treat.
Because they're so nice. Expensive. The most recent ones I can think of is like maybe the Jumanji movies.
Yeah.
But then again, they've just got like this.
To me, they're more ensemble movies.
Yeah. They just got this like glossy CGI look to them. There's no authenticity to those films, even though they are like
despite this being 2D, it does look like an authentic type adventure.
Yeah,
film.
Yeah. I think that comes with. I don't think this would have had this. It wouldn't have had the same effect if it was 3D animated. I think you need that organic tactility, that kind of grit to it. I like kind of the classic style of animation. Like, you just got the beautiful matte backgrounds and, like, the very simply coloured character cells. The thing that I noticed, I think it gave the film kind of a classic look, but I don't know if you guys would have preferred different, but there's no gradients in any of the character models.
Yeah.
Did you notice?
Yeah.
There's almost no lighting on them.
They mainly do it with their lighting effects. Like when Kida uses her crystal and it glows on them, you see the blue.
Oh, no, there's still
shadows.
There are parts. I'm just saying, not to the same extent. There's no real kind of shading gradient. If a character is in shadow, they tend to shade the entire model evenly.
I think that works, though, because it works for the type of film it is. Complex.
Yeah. Because you do want to focus on the world and the background and the focus, like while the characters, you know, are interesting and they're nicely designed and they're nice to look at. The focus is this world.
Mm. Yeah.
And this kind of just this desolate, cavernous landscape. Mm. It's really nice.
Stefan, what do you think?
That ship graveyard? Oh, we'll get to that, though. That's amazing. Yeah.
But everything in this film, I just think, is really grand. It's all big and mythical, and it goes from big explosion to bigger explosion to biggest explosion. It just keeps exploding.
Oh,
something I love about this film, unlike most Disney things, is there are actually stakes in this film. People die.
People are dying left and right.
They just die all the time.
Yeah.
Like, they kill off Buddy Kida's father.
Yeah. And they play into tropes of their characters in this, in that they're kind of all stereotyped and cutouts.
It's very tropey.
They all have like little moments where they all get their comebacks. Like the femme fatale gets the final thing that beats the bad guy.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's such
a fun. She gets her little one-liner.
Yeah, it's such a fun adventure romp with such great mystery and lore building things of finding this lost city. And there's not many films, especially in animation, that live up to this sort of grandiosity in terms of set piece, action, and
it's so hard to do like grandiose theatricality and animation, and they nail it off.
Like,
just
everything's iconic. Like the ship is iconic, the crab is iconic, the drill. I love that.
See, that's the only thing I remember.
You only remember the drill.
Yeah, I don't remember anything else from the film apart from that drill. I thought I was going to be in it more, and I was a bit upset.
No, it's only the one shot I remember. The drill is when they're coming through the light in the tunnel. And it's just the drill leading the way.
I'll just get into the one thing I didn't really like.
Yeah.
So this film does use quite a bit of 3D assets in it, which is good for the most part, except for the assets used in Atlantis itself for the buildings.
Okay.
I thought some of it was very, very noticeably 3D and not well integrated.
Okay.
And like as soon as I saw it, I thought, oh man, that is a bit of an eyesore, which really sucked, seeming as most of the film is really, really gorgeous.
Look, considering it's 19 years old now,
I know.
Damn. You can really let it go for
but
that.
But like Tarzan came out before this, and that used the 3D trees and vines a lot better than this did the 3D.
It was still
buildings.
A little bit janky.
To be fair, though, the Tarzan, for the vines in Tarzan, that was just one asset, whereas this really used almost everything that wasn't characters 3D.
I just think they could have done it a little bit better. Where, like, even if they just added some toon lines around some of, like, the moss and stuff on the buildings, it would have been a lot better. But some of it it's so noticeably 3D and, like, early 3D as well.
Mm.
That's the only complaint, though, I have about, like, the aesthetics.
Mm. Is there parts you want to start talking about, Michael?
No. The entire film, I think, is engaging. My favourite part is the more traditionally kind of pulpy adventure stuff, which is the thing. Around the first half.
Yeah.
Because they get to Atlantis at almost exactly halfway through the film.
But I still think the adventure stuff in Atlantis is just as good.
I think it's fun.
It's still fun, but I liked kind of the angry industrialization of the first half more than I enjoyed like the more kind of free-flowing
spirit. That's more your style, though.
Yeah. I liked that more than kind of the free-flowing spirituality of the second half.
I really love the spirituality stuff and like the ruin. Like, that sort of stuff in adventure stuff is what gets me. Like, the ruins and, like, them exploring the cultures and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Like, this is, like, controversial, but my least favourite part of adventure films is when they get to, like, the lost city.
Okay.
That makes
sense. My favorite part is the build up where like kind of they fight the Nazis.
Honestly, that's the same with Uncharted. I love every level until you actually get to Lost City and then it just becomes escape the city you've destroyed.
Yeah, exactly. Stop blowing up cities, Mr. Drake.
Drake, come on, you had one job. Yeah, I really love that part. And that part also reminds me of the whole Watchmen ethos, which why I think it relates to you more. Mm. That first part. Because that part's
Watchmen?
No, Watchmen like... I mean like Mike Mignola kind of that aesthetic, that comic book aesthetic, that first part. It feels more comic booky than the second
part. It does. I would describe it as Watchmen, but I describe it as
That was just my
kind of like a graphic novel look.
So, animation-wise, in this, Milo was really well animated, and I really like that. So, first with his character design, he is very scrawny. And in every single shot that he is in, you can notice that he is scrawny, especially in the second half where he's just in the tank top. And, like, you can see his shoulder blades, his back blades. Yeah.
It kind of hangs off him.
And the shading on him just really emphasizes that as well. And I really thought that was great because it wasn't your typical, like... somewhat muscly action hero guy. No, just the scrawny book nerd. He was really good.
He was modelled after their linguist who actually worked on their team.
Oh, that's really cool. Seeming as he's a cartographer and does deal with languages.
Yeah.
Him and the general dude, I think, were animated the nicest.
Mm.
That kind of makes sense considering he's the protagonist and the main anti.
But like Milo's also like his facial animation though was
Each character, really though, good. Had a supervisor in charge of them.
Yeah, oh, that makes sense. Every single character in this is very noticeably different, which is great. Like, they all have their own uniqueness about them. They have different, what's it called, silhouettes.
Yeah, the Mac grading philosophy.
That's the thing that I know Michael would really appreciate. Every character in this has a clear silhouette. Like, you can tell exactly who they are, what they are, what they're like, just from looking at them.
Draw your characters so that they're distinguishable by their silhouette.
Mole looks exactly what you would think a mole would look like.
Yeah.
And Sweet, the doctor... Yep. Exactly what you would think his character would be, and each character has that.
Yeah, he's great.
I really like the... Yeah, Sweet.
I love all the supporting cast. They have, like, what, three lines each, but each one sells their character.
That Italian demolitions expert is hysterical.
He has the best one-liners in
this. He's the funniest.
He's constantly
Maybe people got hurt, but nobody we knew. He kind of speaks like Sylvester Stallone. It wasn't like a stereotypical Italian accent. No, it was kind of like a low droll. It was really funny.
But no, I'm really glad, like, I could see it coming, but I'm really glad, like, with the tropes of them being this team that sticks together, and you could tell they were siding with the military, but then, like, you could tell that they were going to side with Milo.
Yeah.
But still, like, how they progressed from that, like...
It's believable.
The actual reveal that everyone is a traitor, like, initially, is actually quite ballsy, I think.
I could tell it was coming.
I couldn't. I thought, because I, like, as soon as it started, like, that general, that he's got to fight the general guy.
General guy was very easily telegraphed.
But he's even designed in a way when he's a bit more angular than everybody else. But I didn't think that initially, like, they were all kind of mercenaries. They're all in it for the money initially, and they only turned a little bit later on.
A lot of them are in it for the mercenary, the money. That's why
I like that. Again, it's that kind of cynicism that gives it that bite.
It's like at the campfire, they said they're all in it for the money, and Milo was the only one, and he said he's in it for the history and the adventure.
Yeah. Oh, that's like, in it for the money is like one of the funniest jokes at the end, when he's like, let me get this straight. You went down there and you found nothing. It just comes to the wide shot, and they're all just in suits.
But the characters, like, all the secondary characters of that team were all really well developed, from the introductions to that campfire scene where you find out, like, what drives them. Like, how the teen engineer, how, like, what drove her was, like, setting up the future for her family.
And that's a bit convenient that they have, like, a little campfire that says all their personalities. But I think it works well for an adventure film.
Exactly.
And what I love is it builds into what you said before. It's a great adventure film, but it also inadvertently becomes an ensemble film because these characters are all, like, big characters that have big personalities you can really see. And it's all just them mashing together in this big ensemble. And it's great. Something I did want to talk about, because it's actually one of my favourite scenes
in the film. Is it Atlantis itself?
It's part in Atlantis. It's the part where Kida gets brought up by the crystal.
Yes.
So that scene with the water and how it has those blues that just look haunting is gorgeous.
Yeah. It is really good and really well animated as well. Like, Kida, her animation is probably the most sporadic in the fact that she has a lot of energy and she, like, moves around the most, I would say.
Probably with a design that would not be used by Disney standards nowadays, because she has, like, midriff completely showing and lots of legs showing. But
was she voiced by the lady who does Susie from the Rugrats?
I don't know.
I only know Michael J. Fox in this film.
Okay, because her voice was familiar, and she's quite a prolific voice actress.
Even like her initial design, where she had that huge headpiece on.
Yeah, the masks.
And, yeah, the mask with all that ruffling around. That would have been like such a hassle to animate, but it's so well done. And like, I love everything about how I think they presented the culture in this really well.
Yeah.
Like, I was expecting it to be, you know, somewhat racist because it's, you know, not modern Disney, but no. I think they handled it really well.
Like, yeah, the characters there, though, are all endearing. Like, there's no part of it you think, oh, this is a typical, stereotypical tribe, like in Superman v. the... in that 50s cartoon. This,
yeah.
Although this has the atmosphere of a 50s adventure, it has a lot more modern understanding of characters and gender. Like, no matter gender, like, all the characters are badasses.
Yeah.
It's great. And they even make a point to say that their team was comprised of the best men and women.
Mm.
And I think for 2001, that's pretty good, having that sort of standard in terms of storytelling and characters.
Like, it's even the femme fatale, who did side with the general when the team split up. She ends up
having a redemption at the very end, and it's such a badass, like, it's only business, and she shoots her flare.
My one story thing I didn't like was how they... Like, I get it why they had to have Kira as the battery.
Yeah.
But I didn't like how they took her out of commission for the final fight, because I think... Like,
she would have been the most useful for the final fight.
The final fight reminded me of the Rise of Skywalker final battle. Just, like, this, like, massive ships and, like, dogfighting. Mm. Yeah, no, it's who I thought it was. It's Kree, Princess Keita. It's Kree Summer, and she is, like, a really prolific voice actress. She's done 322 projects.
My goodness.
Which is crazy.
Mm.
But, yeah, Atlantis itself, I wish we could have spent a bit more time. I understand story-wise why we couldn't, but I just love how they presented that world. I would have wanted to spend so much more time there, because...
Exactly. Like,
I'm guessing that's why they made a sequel, but the sequel isn't set in Atlantis, is it?
The problem with this movie is that they were really banking on it being great, because as you can tell, it had all the planning, it had all this. They were originally going to have a ride in Disneyland, they were going to have a sequel, a spin-off series, but it just didn't it didn't hit because Shrek came out, and everyone went to go see Shrek.
Yeah.
And so this didn't make the money, Disney cancelled all their properties for this, and so it bombed. Which is a shame, because when you see this film, you see the love and the craft in every single thing. And it feels different. It feels unique. It's got that edge that most Disney films don't have. And my main complaint I have about how this film was received is that one of the reviews literally said, "Where are the songs?" It's like, does it need songs?
Everyone's too busy shooting each other.
It's clearly, like, when you watch it, it's clearly a serial type adventure film.
Yeah.
It's not a musical.
It doesn't need songs.
And I guess, like, I understand that people were confused about what the target demographic was. Because I think this is an era of, like, budding computer animation, where computer animation was potentially seen as more adult or more family-oriented, where the 2D animation was reserved strictly for children or younger kids.
Okay.
And I think when you start to see this, like, it's a traditionally animated film.
You think it's kids, but it ends up being more adult.
Yeah, no, and then you watch it, and it's, like, set in the 1910s, and everyone's angry.
Everyone's perfectly fine.
Everyone's shade-spoken.
I still think it's perfectly fine for a kid to watch.
It is. I just think that it's got a little bit more grit than I think people were expecting, and that may have alienated some families. Because, there are a lot of, like, on-screen character deaths, and...
There's nothing too graphic, though.
It's not graphic, but, like, the context is quite grim.
What do you think of the fact that the source of power for Atlantis needs a human body sometimes?
It's a plot device. So that's how I took it. You need some kind of sacrificial stake.
No, what I interpreted that as is they said, like, the crystal is like their battery, their deity. Mm. I feel like, and especially they kind of hinted at the end that when they bring down Keita, she has the bracelet that the mother took from her when she was beamed up Scotty. And so it makes it seem as if all the Atlanteans who die go into this crystal and keep it powered. So it's almost as if that is all of Atlantis, that crystal.
Mm.
And so when she went up there, Keita actually met her mum.
Yeah, she's like partly with her mother. Yeah. Or at least some kind of like life
energy. Like physical, metaphorical, that sort of thing, existential, all those long words. I like that. It builds into that lore. You don't need to know exactly how it works. You can just accept that it's space magic and watch people shoot each other.
Mm. I just think it's a bit of a cop-out to get Kira out of the final battle.
No, I really don't think it is. It built the stakes up, because the second the crystal and her were gone, there was no one to protect Atlantis, and so they had to rely on Mole, and he's
crazy.
Why did I say Mole first?
Yeah, if anything, you should say
Milo.
I wish the movie was just called Mole and His Crew.
Actually, I thought Mole was going to be in it more as a comic relief. I'm glad they kept it down a bit.
Yeah.
He was gross. I didn't like looking at him. I liked that Italian guy.
He's the best.
Did he remind you of Avatar somewhat?
Yes, it does.
Mm. I know a lot of the time it's like a Dances with Wolves kind of like metaphor for like colonialism.
Is a lot more subtle than Avatar.
This is a lot more subtle than that, but it reminded me in terms of just the themes of...
Yeah.
Is it more subtle?
They never exactly explicitly say...
Oh, Avatar is a lot more blunt, 100%. But
I think it's
this
about
you get swept in the adventure.
It's equally as blunt. It's just delivered in a way that doesn't seem it.
No, Avatar is an incredibly kind of like narratively clunky movie. It's a powerhouse of VFX.
But story-wise, it's just doing the motions.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, like, I understand like a framework is something that you like a story framework is something that you can hang a visual spectacle on. But to me, I didn't think, even back then, I didn't think that the spectacle was epic or theatrical enough to warrant the amount of attention that
I think the world building in that is the best, because I really like the world in it.
Maybe I'm just
and how they set it up.
Hmm. I think it's good. I think it's creative.
It's a very different type of world that we usually get. That's all, you know.
Yeah. I gotta also remember that it came out whatever it was,
2000 end of 2009, I think.
Yeah, so it came out like 10-11 years ago. So
I actually prefer Fern Gully. And I know the two actually get...
Oh, the smoke monster from Fern Gully.
Oh, Hexus was badass.
So Atlantis.
Oh, no, yeah, but it reminded me a little bit of that in terms of, like, this kind of angry, traitorous, militant, industrialized society encroaching on this untouched, magical, spiritual people.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's some kind of, like, colonialist undertones to
but
it.
This was done better, though.
And it's Disney-fied to an extent, when they meet them, they're initially very welcoming and very happy, and, like, the military general doesn't just shoot everyone on sight, which I presume back then they probably would have. But, no. I'm glad they didn't, like, again, we were talking about before, I'm glad they didn't stray away from that, just the pure, unmitigated greed that drives that entire crew, because they are basically guns for hire. And they do have kind of, like, a moral change of heart at the end. But, they do that while still maintaining this air of kind of grisly like realism, which I enjoyed.
Something I really want to talk about with it being an adventure serial and whatnot, because it's definitely one of my favorite aspects of the film, which there's not much said about it, but is the soundtrack not the most epic thing you've ever
heard? Oh, the soundtrack's fantastic. I was thinking that, especially
it's so triumphant and just like action adventure. Like when the shuttle first goes into the water, it's like this grand sweeping like orchestra. It's everything, and it's amazing.
We did, like you said before, we did not get a lot of that submarine.
No,
we didn't.
It's on the poster. It's on the DVD. It's like the little thumbnail on Disney Plus.
And I barely remember that.
In it for maybe
giant Leviathan fight as well.
Yeah, it's in it for maybe 6 or 7 minutes.
But it's iconic as anything. Like you remember the exact shot of when
it comes down and then it pans into the main window. Like,
yeah.
There's even little animation moments. Like there's a bit when like they're driving the Jeep and there's a wide shot and they stop it. And if you look inside the Jeep, they've completely animated the characters driving them.
Yeah.
They've got
the gear stick, they've got everything.
Didn't need to. Could have been an opaque window. But they chose to do it.
I love how they also do it's a minor thing and they use it as a one off gag, but where Milo's working the boiler room and then that comes back in the when he's fixing the drill.
Bloody set up and payoff.
Yeah, it's great.
Good
but they're
stuff.
Little subtle things. Like, it's not the blunt
I love
thing
how he knows...
in Skywalker where it's like, oh, never, a droid, don't underestimate them. 5 seconds later, oh, droid, don't underestimate
I should have
them.
Underestimated the droid.
Oh. Whereas this is a lot more... Sorry, Ben. The bashes are big.
Now, the foreshadowing of Star Wars
Remember last night how I was just complaining and complaining and complaining about it? Go on, I don't care anymore.
Has the acceptance set in? You've gone through the stages of grief?
Like, at about 1 o'clock last night, yes.
You
he
finally accepted it
me
after we saw it at Christmas. But
processing it.
No, the Star Wars setup and payoff is more like set up and then completely contradict the payoff.
Yeah.
No, it's because I watched the Clone Wars trailer and was like, this is so good.
This is the Star Wars I miss.
And then we just got The Rise of Skywalker and why can't it be as good? The Atlantean technology, what do you think?
I loved it. I love how they look like fish and they like use the palm to activate things.
I like how when they're trying to activate the little like speeder cart there, he's reading the Atlantean script and it just reads like instructions. It just reads like you're starting a microwave.
I really like how cohesive it all is. It's even like including the crystals that everyone has and how that's like sort of a key for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you can all tell it's Atlantean technology. Even like the giants at the very end protecting the city. And
there's mysticism to it, but it's domestic to them.
Yeah.
Like it's just run of the mill. Like they operate it like we would machinery.
And the Leviathan as well, I wasn't expecting that to be their technology, which I thought was a great reveal in how they did it, with like Milo looking at its eye and then it's the camera lens closing.
They even set up like a little fake out where he's just like, the script says that it's the city's protected by a giant Leviathan, but there may be a translation error, it's probably just a statue.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of both. Yeah.
But I love how over detail they get with their Atlantean, how detail they get into it, where when the lava goes over the entire city, and it becomes like stone hard.
Yeah.
It cracks with all the Atlantean symbols.
Yeah, I thought that was really great.
Like it could have just cracked normally, but no, they're like, nah, this has to be an Atlantean lava cracking.
But I think that makes sense within their universe and how their shields might work.
Yeah, they really go all in with their lore. They don't half it. They go, okay, we're going to make this Atlantis. We're going to make everything about it Atlantean so you recognize every single little thing.
Yeah, it was supposed to be completely, like, developmentally isolated. So it
and they do that in animation, which is not an easy feat.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was a bit of a cop-out that they could speak English, but
I liked how they led to that.
Yeah, I liked how they did it.
Oh, that doesn't make sense at all.
No, it doesn't make sense, but I like how they tried to
explain when he says like their accent must be based on like a base dialect, so all other languages kind of stem from their language, but that doesn't mean that they know what the other languages
look,
are.
Look, you can't have them spending
the crystal would like read your emotions or something and translate accordingly. I thought that would have made more sense. Then
that's more of a MacGuffin though, and
it just reminded me of the Amazons from like Wonder Woman where they just know all the languages. It's like how do you know what like the word television is? You've been down here for 30,000 years.
But no, Atlantis.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Final thoughts? Quick episodes? Last one was an hour and a half.
There's not much to say that I haven't already said. I love every character. I love the designs. And it just feels like it. For me, this is better than Aladdin, which Aladdin for a long time was my favorite adventure Disney film.
Oh, okay.
But this feels vibe. This feels bigger in every regard. With adventure, characters, and just everything. It's just grander, and it really takes the spectacle key from 2D animated Disney to the highest I think it ever achieved in the early 2000s. I don't think anything got above it, honestly, but that's just my opinion.
My final thought is, you know, it's everything that I've said. It's really good. There's a few things that I've nitpicked, but overall it's a really solid, great adventure film that I'll definitely watch again.
Go watch it. I really enjoyed it. It's probably worth starting a little Disney Plus trial over, and then don't renew it because there's very little else of value. Good night.
Unless if you want to watch The Mandalorian.
Or Gravity Falls.
That's not bad, actually. I'm not the biggest Star Wars fan, but The Mandalorian's a lot of fun.
Watch Atlantis. Maybe the sequel. I don't know. Is it good? I haven't watched it.
I'll edit this in earlier, but the sequel was basically the three pilot episodes they had for the TV series that they just slammed into one TV movie.
Yeah. So does it look a lot cheaper?
A lot cheaper. It's not even in Atlantis.
Oh.
They go to the outside world.
Yeah.
But some of the concepts are fun, but because it was meant to be a weekly TV show, you can tell that it's not as polished.
I mean, the outside world is fun because it's an era not often explored, not only in animation, but in media in general. Like the 1910s is not a very romantic period. Like, we don't consider that a romantic period culturally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was just filled with tragedy and warfare and like international incidents. So. Yeah,
unlike the 1940s. Haha, romantic.
No, which 1940s are just romantic, filled with lovely things like honey and rainbows and World War II. Yeah. Go watch Atlantis. It's really good.
It's shorter than you think.
It'll help
you
forget.
Only 90 minutes.
Yeah. Go
which
watch
is Michael's
it.
Michael's baseline.
It's in not Michael's baseline. If Michael can watch it, you can watch it.
Exactly. It'll help you forget that the country is literally on fire. So.
Yeah.
So, Ben, where can you find us? Who are we?
No, we're not doing that yet.
Aren't we? What are we doing?
Next week.
Oh, what are we doing next week?
Oh, next week we're doing the film that sank Atlantis.
Oh!
Shrek.
The musical. No, just Shrek.
Just normal Shrek.
Yeah.
I'm really upset we didn't do Shrek the Halls.
Shrek the Halls next Christmas. But the initial plan was to do Shrek 2, because I genuinely think it's the best animated comedy of all time.
But I think we should start with the
first
one.
But we'll start
first,
and we'll just see the Shrek films progressively get worse. We might do a Shrek Day, when we'll do like Shrek 3 and 4 in the same video.
Let's not do Shrek 3, let's just skip to Shrek 4.
We'll skip Shrek 3.
Okay, if you want to... reach out to us. We are at animate3pod@gmail.com. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on YouTube. And have a good day. Bye.
Yep.